Okay, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you all so much for being here tonight for week, I'm going to check my notes, week five of the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. So tonight we're featuring writers Jen Ashburn, Charlie Bryce, and Judy Bryce. Unfortunately, John Rep and Sheila Scalante couldn't be here tonight, but we wish them the best and are looking forward to hosting them in the future, of course. So just a reminder that for the next 3 weeks, the last 3 weeks of the Hemingway series, we're past the halfway mark. They'll all be here at White Whale for the rest of the summer, which is really exciting. So thanks to Joan and Chris for... also, Halsey wrote this intro and they want me to say happy belated solstice. So happy belated solstice to all of you. A little bit about myself and about White Whale Bookstore quickly. I'm Anna, the events director here at the store. White Whale Bookstore, for those of you who are not familiar, but I think everybody here has either been to an event like this many times or is a regular customer. We're a family-owned general interest independent store in the Bloomfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Our store motto is conversation, community, and culture, and we strive to be a home for book lovers. Our events programming features local, national, and international writers and translators reading, discussing, and celebrating literature of all genres and for all ages. So a couple of events coming up that I just wanted to shout out for all of you. Tomorrow, June 29th at 7 p.m. Eastern, sort of a last minute scheduling thing for us, but we were super excited to do it. We're ecstatic to welcome Joel Diaz Porter to the store to celebrate his collection of poetry, Ideas of Improvisation. And he'll be joined by a cherished local writer and recent Guggenheim recipient, Yona Harvey, for a reading. So that's here at the store. I'm pretty sure it'll be live streamed. I just have to check with them. So just check back on the events page on the website if you wanted to RSVP for that. On Thursday, June 30th at 7 p.m., we're virtually hosting Tori Bovolino in celebration of her latest novel, Not Good for Maidens. And she'll be joined by Kit Frick, author of Very Bad People. So we also have sort of a cool book giveaway for that. This is a YA novel that, if you love YA, you should just pick it up, but it's good for the teens in your life too. We have these stickers and a postcard and all our copies are signed. Like, there's a lot of swag that comes with the book, so it's worth checking out. And then next month on Friday, July 15th at 7 p.m. Eastern, for you to mark all your calendars, we have a virtual poetry reading coming up with Bronwyn Tate, Lin Zhu, Kate Chiapira, Michael Todd Edgerton, and Caroline Noble Whitbeck. And that'll be a really wonderful evening of poetry online. So you can find out more about these events and so many other things on our website, whitewellbookstore.com. So we're currently live streaming this event. Hello to the people on the live stream. We've got a good crowd on there. So like at least these numbers, which is cool. We appreciate you all being here with us tonight in person and virtually. So protocol for folks who are here with us in the store, we ask that you keep your mask on at all times. The authors will only take theirs off to read here at the mic like I'm doing. The restrooms are behind me, but I just ask that if possible, you hold off from going back there until after the reading. The door at the back of the cafe is locked just so that I can check fax cards on this side. But at the end of the evening, if you want to go out that way, feel free to, the bolt's right on the door. You can flip that and bounce. And we have copies of all three of the writers' books on this side where I'm going to be. So definitely come over, check them out. Feel free to stick around and browse at the end of the night. Your support of the store is what makes free events like these possible. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Chris Collins, who kicks off. Thank you all.
Hey there. Thanks, Anna. Always lovely to be at White Whale. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Thanks to our wonderful readers. We are very sad that Sheila and John couldn't join us tonight, so we send them our love and good vibes. And thanks for the Zoom folks for tuning in. I missed last week because I was dealing with some stuff. So what are we doing? Where are we? What is this? I never know where I'm at anymore. We have a new baby, so there you go. So yeah, welcome to Hemingway's at White Whale. So I'm gonna read this to you real quick. This is Virginia Woolf's diary entry from March 8th, 1941. Just back from Leonard's speech at Brighton. Like a foreign town, the first spring day. Women sitting on seats, a pretty hat in a tea shop. How fashion revives the eye. And the shell-encrusted old women, rouged, decked, cadaverous at the tea shop. The waitress in checked cotton. No, I intend no introspection. I mark Henry James's sentence, observe perpetually. Observe the oncome of age. Observe greed. Observe my own despondency. By that means, it becomes serviceable. Or so I hope. I insist upon spending this time to the best advantage. I will go down with my colors flying. This I see verges on introspection, but doesn't quite fall in. Suppose I bought a ticket at the museum, biked in daily and read history. Suppose I selected one dominant figure in every age and rode round and about. Occupation is essential. And now with some pleasure, I find that it's 7 and must cook dinner, haddock and sausage meat. I think it is true that one gains a certain hold on sausage and haddock by writing them down. This is the last entry in the writer's diary, which was edited by her husband, Leonard, about 10 years after Virginia Woolf died. She would take her own life about 20 days after this entry was written. And I find, as a writer, as a host of a writing series, even in this moment, 1941, where she's already lost her home to the Blitz. She's been bombed out of her house. She's struggling with the depression that is going to take her life in about 20 days. She still finds a centering quality, a stability in the ability, not the ability, but in the fact of writing things down. Of witnessing her own life and the world. Earlier, about a few days, she wrote this in the diary. This trough of despair shall not, I swear, engulf me. We know that it did, but again, the fact of writing that very sentence down in a diary, which meant she wasn't looking to publish this. She was just writing for an audience of one single person who needed to hear what was being said. And I think that's what we do as writers. That is our job, to observe. It is very easy, certainly for myself, in these last few years especially, to feel that what is the point? What is the good of what I do when I write a poem or a book review or whatever we write? Our job is to be witnesses. Our job is to observe. That is, in itself, an incredibly important thing. It was something that Virginia Woolf knew, even as she was struggling to survive, not just through a war, but through her own depression. And the fact that she didn't win that fight isn't the important fact. The fact is that she felt that the language and the writing that she did was what mattered, not just to her, but to people and to history. So I'm reading Ada Calhoun's new book, purchased from White Whale. Get your copy today. This is a book about her father, the art critic Peter Schadl, and Frank O'Hara. And if you know me, you know I love reading anything about Frank O'Hara. And I came across this today, and I thought it echoed. So Calhoun is writing about O'Hara, and she writes this short paragraph. And this is about the critic Helen Venler. In The Virtues of the Alterable, written by Venler, literary scholar Henry Venler discusses an O'Hara poem about a night out dancing. That poem, if you're interested, is At the Old Place, which is a very lively poem about dancing at a gay bar, or dancing at a bar with other gay men, that O'Hara wrote. She says, "Why is it worth recording?" It's Venler. "Because it happened." Why is what happened worth recording? Because what else is there to record? And why should we want to read it? Because what else is there to know except what has happened to people? What we write has value well beyond the confines of our lives and the time that we're living in, and will continue to do so as long as there are people on this planet. The people who are going to read tonight are contributing to a long, long line of humanity, capital H. And I just wanted to thank them for that tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Well, it's really great to have you all here tonight, and a big hi to all the folks on Zoom. Thank you for being there. Thank you for all of you folks who are here. And this is week five, and our first poet tonight, I will introduce in a moment. I will first tell you what's going to happen in 2 weeks, because I might forget otherwise. On Tuesday, July the 12th, week six, only 2 weeks, right? Our readers will be Angele Ellis, Heather McNauer, Danielle Obisi, Orlu Richard St. John, and Don Wentworth. And so that's a heads up. We really hope you'll all be here for that. It will be wonderful. And now I will introduce Jan Ashburn and I. Really, I think, got to know each other through the Ridge series, which we're both involved with, on the leadership of Chris Collins and Jason Ballinger, that got that series together, that brought together poetry and literature and policy and community involvement. And it was just a great joy. And we had a lot of fun. So it's really happy to have her reading tonight. Jan Ashburn is the author of The Light on the Wall, published by Main Street Rag. Her work has appeared in numerous venues, including Fiddlehead, Writer's Almanac, Pedestal Magazine. She holds an MFA from Chatham and is a member of the Carlo University Mad Women in the Attic workshops. She has taught creative writing and community workshops and currently teaches first year writing at Duquesne University. Woohoo! And I know she's been working on a memoir, and she has a new book of poetry that she's completed. So she has been a busy writer. Please welcome Jan Ashburn.
Thank you, Joan, for that beautiful introduction. And thank you, Chris, for those thoughtful comments about writing in Virginia Woolf's diary. I really appreciated that. And thanks to all of you for coming out tonight and everyone who's watching online. And I'm real happy to be reading, and I'm really happy to be reading with Judy Bryce, who has had some health problems. And I'm just real glad to see you today, and with Charlie Bryce as well. So I am going to read a few poems from a manuscript I've been working on. The manuscript is tentatively called This Is How the World. And the first poem I'll read is called Tackle. Can everyone hear me?
Oh, yeah.
All right, thanks. And the poem does play on the many definitions of tackle. They're in the poem, but sometimes you can't catch things the first time you hear them. So tackle can refer to a system of pulleys that can be called tackle. Tackle is an ample word as a verb to undertake, for example, a problem, to seize or bring down, for example, a football player. As a noun, gear for fishing or handling a ship, a system of pulleys. My mother was good at using power tools. She also heard voices in her head. My father said she was a hell of a carpenter. My father is old school. In cool weather, he left dead animals, say a hog or deer, hoisted up with pulleys in our backyard until he had time to process the meat. Kids marveled at this when the bus collected my brother and me to learn things like spelling and fractions, which are useful skills. Yes, I like to think I could survive in the woods and, MacGyver-like, snare rabbits with pipe cleaners. In 1994, as a member of the National Guard, I spent 2 weeks in Salina, Kansas, learning how to use a system of pulleys to recover vehicles stuck in mud. As an exercise, we pulled a deuce and a half with rope and the power of our own muscles. If I were to live in the woods, I would take rope, chains, pulleys, fishing gear, boots, a container for water, and a hatchet, of which there are at least a dozen different kinds, Tomahawk, Pulaski, firefighting, Hudson Bay, each with its own purpose, each with its own shape. I would take a Pulaski hatchet and drive the blade through oak bark and the adze through oak root. What I'm trying to say is, if I had to, I could live in the hollow of a tree. My mother was very afraid and possessed a vinegary wit. No wonder she hid in the roof rafters. I was very afraid and practical. No wonder I now keep 12-pound boxes of chicken thighs in my freezer. In truth, I don't know how to snare or skin rabbits, though I can fry them up in a cast iron pan. In truth, I grew up in an era of light brights and Barbie dolls, but I saw some things. I have not once since 1994 pulled a vehicle out of mud, yet I find satisfaction in calculating a pulley system's mechanical advantage. I find comfort in load resistance, tackle resistance, friction, force, and strength. Thank you. This next poem is in 6 parts, a long poem for me. And there are 2 voices. I think it'll be evident. The Hey Private guy is a different voice than the narrator. I think you'll get it. Indoctrination in 6 movements. 1. I was 18 and not much of a runner, not to mention my eyesight was bad, but I joined the National Guard for reasons I still don't understand. Then in midsummer, boarded my first ever plane to Fort Dix, New Jersey, the same base where my father processed out of the Army after Vietnam. I was 18 and frumpy in my BDUs, but I guess I did okay because I never got in too much trouble, though some girls did. Some mouthed off or got caught with candy bars, and one girl got caught smoking and said, "The heck with this," and walked off base, and we never saw her again. We were all 18 or 20 or maybe 25 and generally naive about things like the military industrial complex and what exactly we'd gotten ourselves into, but it wasn't so bad. These weren't the draft days of my father's generation with rabid drill sergeants like in the movies who screamed "fuckhead" with every other breath and schemed with Hollywood style revenge. No, it wasn't so bad. We were healthy and young and by and large could withstand the push-ups and sit-ups and running, the marching and saluting, the scrubbing of latrines, the shooting of M16s, the throwing of grenades, the 4 a.m. wake-ups and general conformity the U.S. Army required of us. Though there was the small matter of Kuwait, a country I'd never heard of before, invaded by Saddam Hussein and Iraq's Republican Guard. And so U.S. forces gathered at the Saudi Arabian border, and the drill sergeants began to say, like a mantra, "Private, you're going to Saudi," whenever we showed signs of becoming prima donnas. And though we were supposed to be hard-charging soldiers, it would be a lie to say we weren't a little anxious about the whole oil-drunk ordeal. Two. "Hey, private, you want to run 3 miles at dawn, work all day behind the firing range berm, breathe the sulfur that sinks in the heat? Hell yeah. Private, you want to count these bayonets? You want to PMCS that truck? You want to pack those wheel bearings with grease? Want to drive that Humvee, find out why it's overheating? Want to wax the floor, untangle that camouflage netting? Want to take these forms to Sergeant Peters? Want a cigarette, cigar, a beer? Hey, private, why'd you join up? You want to be a hero?" I knew a man who said he had run another man over while driving a 5-ton cargo truck on a convoy to Mississippi. Saw the blood through the water forging window. Never stopped, never looked back. You think that's true? Aw, hell, private, do your time and get out. Wear your combat boots when you mow the lawn. Three. Private Getz was 18 and not very good at running or shooting or throwing grenades or much of anything, it seemed. She also frequently neglected to shower, owing to a painful shyness, perhaps, and a fear of the semi-open shower stalls. Private Getz had a schizophrenic mother, as I had. Private Getz planned to return to her mother's house after training, that is, if we didn't get shipped to Saudi. I hadn't seen my mother in several years. I no longer opened her letters. I was 18 and a bit of a prima donna. I did not like Private Getz much, and I did not want to hear about her mother, though in a moment of solidarity, or so I thought, on the night march when Getz struggled and another soldier had to carry her pack, I offered an orange, and our eyes met briefly and knowingly, until I cruelly looked away. Four. "Hey, private, why'd you join up?" Money for college. "Why'd you join up?" I like to play rough. I like the smell of motor oil. I like 5 a.m. convoys, the anticipation, the cut of diesel engines burning and churning in early morning fog. "Why'd you join up?" I was tired of working at Burger King. Five. "Private, we all reek of brimstone, the lust of a bull on a chain. It's in us like sex, in dust beaten up from folds of olive drab canvas. I can still taste it. And all of us, from the girl green as a switch, I didn't go to Saudi, to the lifer with bloated liver and jaundiced eyes. A lot of soldiers did, but I wasn't one of them. Every one of us is just a babe, eager, stupid, and blind in the forest, digging with our snouts to find the best route." Six, "What I learned in the military. Wear knee highs under your wool socks to avoid blisters. Squeeze the trigger at the bottom of the exhale. Put instant coffee granules between your molars and cheek to stay awake for guard duty. If a man tries to sleep with you, even though you haven't showered in 3 days, say no. If he also hasn't showered in 3 days, say hell no. When tying a tourniquet, don't forget to elevate the limb. Don't forget to draw a T on the forehead in dirt or blood. Don't forget to treat for shock. If attacked with a nerve agent, don your NBC mask. Inject your number one atropine shot, a short one, into your outer thigh. Hold the needle in place for 10 seconds. Repeat with your number two shot, the long one. Don't go into off-limits areas, which include open fields after dark and a list of bars read aloud at final formation every Friday. Don't write down the names of the off-limits bars and go to them anyway. If you do go to an off-limits bar, don't let anyone steal your money. Don't drink underage, or rather, don't get caught. Thank you. And I have a few poems about my father. This one is called Roadside Assistance. Wednesday, car won't start, called for a jump. Should have had it fixed then, should have gotten AAA. Friday, car won't start, supposed to visit parents out of state, instead took a bus to AutoZone, $120 on a credit card, ratchet set, battery charger, lead shim for a battery post. Shake the cables, my father says over the phone. His lungs are failing, his heart too. He needs a drop of morphine to sleep at night. It's just a loose connection, he says. I'm sure of it. Car fixed by Saturday, half a week for a one-hour job. My father says to my husband, in good humor, you could fuck up an anvil. We're basically kids hitchhiking from town to town, our thumbs wiggling like blind moles poking out of the dirt. Monday, car won't start. Turns out we left the dome light on. True story. This next one is a work in progress. It's after Sharon Olds, and a shout out to Nancy Krigowski, in whose workshop I started working on this. Ode to the tin can telephone. The repurposed houses of diced tomatoes and creamed corn, the scratch of paper still glued across the silver ribs, the cotton string untwining. Ode to the mouth on one end, the ear on the other, the impossibility of the journey, the string never taut enough, the vibrations too loose, too wild, but praise the heroic optimism in the attempt. Praise the fibers, intimate friction, the subtle rotation, the holding on and letting go. And praise the wind that catches the can's lip and says, ooh-wah, a serpentine hello. When my father was ill, he imagined death as flipping a switch, but asked, why can't we talk to each other after? His mind was addled, his whole world a puzzle, and he still jamming knob into socket to order fragments of grass and sky. Praise the will of spirits humming, perhaps through the ether. Ode to the strained and reaching thread. Thank you. And I'd like to close with a Pittsburgh poem, and this goes out to Jason Irwin. When the crows came. You should have seen the crows, says Jason one morning about a flock, or more properly murder, that flew like a great enchanted breath over our apartment building. Were they crows or ravens, and what's the difference? One conjures cornfields, the other a dark house with Edgar Allan Poe's rap, rap, rapping, and neither seems right for Pittsburgh. My friend Alan and I encountered some crows while hiking near Hakodate, Japan. Ours, they called, claiming the fields and wild grass, their shiny beaks biting the air. Okay, yours, I thought, and we laughed and took pictures and went back into town for squid, fried potatoes, and beer. Back in Pittsburgh, I pick up Jason at the Oakland Library, double park with our flashers on. It's 8 p.m. and I want to get home, but Jason rap, rap, raps on the passenger window. Look at the crows, he says, and I step out to find sycamores breathing, pregnant with a you-know-something's watching you air. The crows lift from the tree. We watch with our heads thrown back, our throats exposed. They are one and many, a fierce many, a magnificent flurry darkening an almost night sky. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. Really looking forward to this book.
No pressure, right?
No pressure. It's really a happy occasion to have Judy with us tonight because she has gone through a really tough medical ordeal. And so it is just thrilling that she's here. And so I will, here is now her intro. Judith Alexander Bryce is a retired Pittsburgh psychiatrist whose love of nature and acquaintance with illness, both in herself and others, inform much of her work. She has had over 80 poems published in journals, anthologies, including Vox Populi, Golden Streetcar, Post Gazette, Patterson Literary Review, as well as the Annals of Internal Medicine. Judy has authored 4 poetry books, among them Renditions in a Palette, Overhead from Longing, Imbibe the Air, as well as a chapbook, Shards of Shadows. Have we missed one here? Yeah. Okay. Oh, the new one. Okay. And so it is great, great pleasure that we welcome Judy Bryce.
Time since I've read. Thank you very much for having me, John and Chris, and everybody. I feel very grateful to be here. And I think I'm going to sit backwards and trust my walker here. Let's move this way. Okay. Hello, everybody. So, thanks for having me. That was a lovely reading. Okay. Jen, where are you? There you are. I really enjoyed the reading. Talking to the mic. Sweetie. Talking to the mic. Here I am. Okay, so... one thing I learned is if you're going to be hit with a pandemic and get all virtuous and start writing poetry, it's not a good time to publish books and expect people to know about them unless you do like your husband does and just go at it on Facebook. And I didn't do that. I got sick instead, so I didn't have all that energy to go on Facebook and advertise. And I did write 2 books, and they came out just at the start of COVID, and that was an interesting experience. And so I'm going to read first from the first one that came out, which is a full book, Imbibe the Air, and the second one is Shards of Shadows, a COVID diary. And I really started writing it like almost the first week of COVID. And I gave up after a year and a half or so, but I still got some good poems out. So just a little note about Charlie and me. Most of you guys know, but for many years we had a cottage up in northern Michigan on a lake, and both of our poems relate back to how much we enjoyed being up in Michigan. And this first poem and the name of the book, Imbibe the Air, and the picture in the book is related to how lovely it was up on that lake, Walloon Lake in North. It's really southern Michigan, but the northern part of southern Michigan. Imbibe the air. Sometimes I want to tilt my head aside under the kitchen faucet and take a long drenching sip of water, cool water to quench a thirst of thoughts, a longing of desire, as it slips sideways in my mind and seeks to cry, bellow its drought, its bereft, and morning calls for pause, for surcease, for the advent of rain. Sometimes I just want hydrogen, its unique mix with oxygen, to breathe, to drink my sorrows down. I yearn to imbibe the air, find full seat amid the falling drops as they coalesce to creeks, then drench my desiccating skin, my hair, this body singed dry by despair. Eyes emptied of tears. The lake, that purling plash of waves on sandy shore, still beckons. Thank you. So, I'm gonna find my second poem here. This also goes back to Michigan. And as do our memories. Let's see what I wrote in the corner here. Oh, it's entitled Love in the Afternoon. After Robert Frost, nothing gold can stay. Today, the sun slid back behind the frost, behind the darkening sallow roofs, and lost us to the errant eddies of late fall, her vermilion leaves swirling brown, swirling into a burnished gyre along an all too cold street of black, whose slick gray sidewalks slip smooth beneath the restive remnants of a month called fun, called Indian summer, called love in the afternoon. Today, the wind woke us from our trance of spirit, of joy, perched atop the lady slippers, doting next to the daisies whose white sheaths petaled their sorries. As the breeze turned northerly, then mean, forever reminding us that dawn will ever go down today, and nothing gold, nothing good will stay. Thank you. Let's see. Oh, this is a favorite of most people who read the book. So you guys get it too. So I grew up in Boston, and one of the big stores in downtown Boston was Filene's. It was a big, big department store, if anybody's heard of Filene's. And Filene's basement was a wonder in and of itself. If anybody's gone to Filene's basement, we get almost anything at low rock bottom prices. So this is about Filene's basement. Yvonne Postel too writes about Filene's basement. It's temptation, the aisles and rows of clothes just to be sampled, messed up, ruffled around, put back or not. But little does she know that Filene's was the very spot where I learned to shop, all on my own, without a mother saying, yes, and no, don't touch that, that bikini, that bra, that sexy lingerie, so curiously tempting to the touch, to the thought, to the thoughts that wind a story in your mind. As you finger the lacy underthings, those undies that are scant and there, but almost not. The filigreed stockings, black with designs of stars and lines that might climb a young girl's leg to seduce a gaze from a stranger, handsome, lithe and svelte across the racks. Those days by myself were the true adventure, following, as they did, the time with my mother's friend, Rose, who led me on a buyer's trek when my mom was gone, perhaps just indisposed. That very same friend about whom my mother had remarked needed to wear a girdle because of her oversized rump. Too big without one, too much of a while. Yet it was Rose who sashayed the aisles, wrestled through the rumpled items, the seductive bargains, taught me how to really shop, explore such curious things, such depths of yearning, with offerings alive and sensuous, each and all ensconced in a singular, enticing basement. Thank you all. Go shopping in Filene's sometime. It's really fun. Okay, so this is the last poem in this book, but there's plenty more if you decide to buy one of the books. So this poem is entitled Holding On. Let me get all my paper clips and whatnots and doodads out of the way. Holding On. Holding on. Rise, dawn. Glow your gold to light. Forget the slide of your late and sure to sink again, slipping sun. Rise. Your sight catch the pampas grass blowing wild in restless wind. Tell us of your eyes, how they catch the crimson marcescent leaves of fall, curl, crinkling, spinning wild. Trumpet now your vision, those desperate, delirious twists of oak as they cling to branch, to twig, before the harshest cold that freeze sends in. And tell us all, so that years from now, you'll see them twirling still, those shriveling leaves of massive oaks as they hold on fast, awaiting snow, awaiting spring. Rise, and through the cold, this bright of frost, we'll remember those spinning crimson curls, their home. Thank you. Okay, yep. So I either have two or three poems here. Maybe I don't need to read. So, as I said, when COVID started, I just started writing about living with COVID. And first they were weekly, and then I kind of scratched this one out and scratched that one out. And I didn't quite keep them in order, but the title is Shards of Shadows, a COVID Diary. And it was true to experience, even though it was not true to the truth. COVID-19, week 4, a dream. I need to call my mother in Manhattan, visit her apartment on 85th and 3rd. I see the buildings and rivers that surround those busy avenues, north and south, congested skinny streets, east and west. It's a simple matter of going east, then cross the street, pass a bank, and take the elevator up. You'll arrive at full, wholesome family love, the best, the easy answers on how to live. I want to ask my mother how to navigate this deadly obstacle I can't even see. Yet when I telephone, I get her answering machine. The person whom you're trying to call is disconnected, perhaps now living below the ground or up in heaven, if you can imagine her there, cavorting with all the other dead. No, I scream, you need to hear. I'm desperate for instructions, a direction to go. It's urgent, I repeat. I need to know how to retreat, hide from life, my neighbors, never read the map of their faces or share with them my smile. Thank you. And hold on 1 second. So this is the one I'm sneaking in because I really wanted to read it anyway. A Ghazal of Ghosts. Avram, where are you? I listen for your voice. It's velvet. It's rich sound not to be found. It is lost, not in the bed, the bath, or kitchen, nowhere. Even its shadow can't be found. What's wrong with you, my dear? Oh, my sweet wife, you don't realize I'm gone. Left yesterday with the 3,000 that COVID took. No chance of being found. I look for you in every room, can't feel your hug, your touch, or catch your smile, or caress your face. I search for your calming scent, a single trace nowhere to be found. We tried to save him. There were 5 of us at his bedside, and yet no breath. His body with IVs in his arms, a tube in his throat, but still no heartbeat could be found. Oh, why, God, did you take him? Where has he gone? I still hear his jokes, his laughter, but just as they reach my ear, they crumble to shards. His voice gone, never to be found. Don't you recall I left in the casket yesterday as you wept, left with 3,124 others to join our brothers, our sisters. Think of that, the full number of souls never found. Close to 300,000 now. That's a city the size of Pittsburgh or Madison. What happened to all of you? To Shula, to young Judy, all now gone, yearning to be found. Thank you. And then this is the last one, and the last one in the book. Shards of Shadows, a COVID Diary. Yeah, I'm making a nice mess here. COVID drags on into 2021. The virus, our sequester, our retreat. As we hide inside our homes, inside our masks, cocoon into ourselves, into our slow, foreboding life that harbors too many deaths one day, then the next, even more beyond. And yet each morning brings new silent, new bright fingers of sunrise to chase all masked purple shadows, the gilded light basking our lives with joys of birth, of buzz, opening to change, to surprise, its fruit, its glow, its loves. Thank you all. Thanks for the invitation to me, all of you. I appreciate it. So I'm going to pick up my desk. Good eyes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's amazing. Yeah, that sounds even better.
I'm to Charlie. Yay for Charlie.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
I love my community.
Hi, everybody. So for the last reading, last reader of the evening is Charlie Bryce. He won the 2020 Field Guide Poetry Magazine Contest, placed third in 2021 Allen Ginsberg Poetry Prize. He has a lot of books. Chapbook, All the Songs Sung, his fourth book of poetry, The Broad Grin of Eternity, An Old Woodshop, which he co-authored with Jim Hutt, arrived 2021. And his poetry has been nominated twice for the Best of Net Anthology and three times for the Pushcart Prize. His work has appeared in Chiron Review, Patterson Literary Review, Inspired Magazine, Muddy River Poetry Review, which I really like a lot, and elsewhere. Please welcome Charlie Bryce.
Thank you. Thanks to everyone for coming. And thanks, Joan and Chris, for inviting us to read. It's a real honor to read for the Hemingway series, always. And it's also very nice to be back here at the White Whale Bookstore. It's a beautiful place, and it's very nice to be here. So I thought I'd just start off with reading from my fourth book, The Broad Grin of Eternity. And that came out about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. And in this book, I got on a jag. I started to write all these poems that started with the title, The Truth About This, The Truth About That. And very few of them had to do with any truth about anything, but anyhow. This poem is called The Truth About Indecision, and it actually begins with a little vignette about the last time I read here with Judy at the White Whale. The Truth About Indecision. Our poetry reading was a great success, even though the heavens opened that day in Pittsburgh and turned Maple Avenue, our street, into Deluge Boulevard. The only time I believe in a supreme being, I told my wife, Judy, herself a poet who was to read that night. Only a god could be this nasty, I said, falling into the same self-centered lunacy that my religious friends favor. This is God's revenge upon my poor atheist self, I proclaimed. But she, for in my atheist lexicon, God is an angry woman, relented. The rain stopped, and it was standing room only at our reading. What I really wanted this poem to be about was the day after our reading, when our friends fell in love with the flowers and trees Judy had planted in our backyard. They didn't even mind the organic calling cards our poodle, Muggsy, had left for them. But that's not what I wanted to write about either. It's the names of flowers that inspired this poem. Why did they call them Rose of Sharon? Why not Sharon's Rose? Just the kind of economy an editor requires. What of those gorgeous bursts of pink we call azaleas? Are there azaleas that azaleas negate as immorality negates morality? And where are the lips that tulips connote? Looking at them, a strange misshapen mouth comes to mind, but lips? Were marigolds originally Mary's gold? What happened to the apostrophe? Has someone named Mary ever traded a marigold for goods or cash? What a bright and colorful world it would be if Mary's or Kathy's or Larry's, Johnny's could trade marigolds for movie tickets, tomatoes, maple syrup, or bacon and eggs, especially bacon and eggs. What if flowers became currency? People could pay off mortgages with roses, their cars with orchids, rent with dahlias, and their college debt with peonies. But here's what I really wanted to write about. Daylilies, the only aptly named flower in our garden. They are lilies that last a single day, like the fame of a poet or the bloom of Buddha's final breath. Thank you. And oh geez, about 5 months, 6 months ago, maybe this poem, this book came out. It's Old Woodshop, and I wrote it with my good friend Jim Hutt. It's his photographs. I wrote poems to his beautiful photographs. And I don't know if the domestic and overseas crowd on Zoom can see any of this, but anyway, this is one of the photographs he did, and it's called Engines. And this is the poem. Engines. This is necessary work. Gears grind and grind to grate out nuts and bolts of culture. Ball bearings that let us get our bearings help us bear the burden of what progress brings. Progress, that pulsing word that pummels nature, turns trees into pulp, makes homeless the hoot owl and chickadee. But how we love the smell of print on paper, the curved letters inked across a page, and how much we are willing to forsake for the magic that runs through cables and transformers. How much we love the light it brings. And this one is, I have to show you guys over here. This is the grain chutes. It's at a company called Phelps Mill Grain Chutes. The thing about these grain chutes, about this beautiful photo, is it just goes on and on and on. There's just one layer after the next in there. And there's a little wheel at the bottom. Phelps Mill Grain Chutes. Like a life, anything constructed well has depth, is layered, nuanced, complex. Deep inside one structure is another structure, and still another. Nothing here is black or white, either or, only this, only that. Where is the joist that supports only one God, one race, one path? In the mill, certainty and doubt meet at angles and are mirrored to infinity. Where there is light, the wheel turns. Here is my brand new, hot off the press book. It's called The Ventriloquist, and published by Vortech. These wonderful publishers, these guys have been wonderful to us. And I'm gonna formally launch this book the day after Angel and Rick read here, July 13th at Riverstone Books in Pittsburgh here, and that will also be simulcast. So I hope you all wanna come, and I'm really very proud of this. It's a wonderful book with Rick Clairval, did the cover again. He became too expensive for me now. He wants too much money for the covers, but I still got him at bargain basement on this one. Well, anyway, this poem is called poet framed by snow, and it's for a wonderful, I wrote it for a wonderful Pittsburgh poet, Jason Baldinger. I just love his work. And if you ever get a chance to read any of Jason's work, I know a lot of you are familiar with it. I think it's wonderful. But anyway, this is called Poet Framed by Snow. On the hottest day in June, 91 degrees in Pittsburgh, Jason posts a photo of a trip to Montana taken 1 year before this molten moment in Iron City. In the photo, he wears a stocking cap, a tarn behind him framed by snow-draped mountains. He'll warm up, I think. All he needs is a glass of crisp hooch, campfire stoke embers, and a few words on paper from his poet's pen, words that make each heartbeat count. That coat with comfort, the endless chain of meaningless jobs, the absurd labor of the many he writes about, the broken backs, the broken lives. And this next poem is called Clarity. And you should know two things about this poem. First of all, the name of the priest I mentioned here, I, of course, changed. And also there's a term, aspergillium. Now the aspergillium is this rod-like thing that the priest would put into a holy water boat and then sprinkle people and stuff with. This is called Clarity. I write my friend Jerry to ask if he'll join me in a Zoom poetry reading. He's busy writing essays these days, he replies, and will get back to me, quote, whenever clarity comes around again, unquote. If it's clarity he awaits, it could be years before I hear from him. At 70, I think clarity has lost my address. Maybe not a bad thing. As an altar boy in Cheyenne in the 60s, clarity's avatar was a young priest, Father Coherence, who insisted that we fold our hands in prayer when not handling cruets of wine and water, the holy water boat, or the censer whose sacred contrails perfumed the heavens. We had to cross our thumbs over one another so that even those pudgy digits bodied forth our Savior's bloody sacrifice. In 1968, in Father Coherence's religion class at St. Mary's, clarity made me wait until he passed out all the final exams. Mine was last because I'd answered all the questions perfectly. The only member of my class to get 100%. Clarity dropped by again today when I searched the internet for Father Coherence and found there his shadow. Arrested in 1995 for public lewdness, he'd used his fleshy aspergillium to bless a coat sleeve hanging on a rack and to broaden the space of the disgrace, accused of accusations of molestation by three adolescent boys between 1984 and 2003. And so I offer a prayer for my friend, Jerry. May clarity be for you, a restless relative, one you love, have to put up with when he visits, but doesn't stick around for long. Thank you. Now there are some copies of this book here, you know, for a very reasonable price. But for those of you abroad and overseas who are, you know, listening in, if you just want to email me at Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E dot Rice, B as in boy, R-I-C-E at gmail.com. Well, I'll just get one of these out to you right away. I thought I'd close with a poem. This is a new manuscript. It's called Pinnacles of Hope, and it'll be out in December, actually, with Inspired Press. It's gonna publish it. And this is for actually the publisher, Steve Kott, who has had a lot of difficulty, cardiac issues himself. And this poem is called A Poet's Heart. And it's going to be in an anthology that he's putting together in the UK to help support efforts to for people to get heart transplants there. So this is called A Poet's Heart for Steve Kott. To the entrepreneur, the forest is a trove of toothpicks, but then is it still a forest? Where is the fragrance of pine, the wind-combed trees, the crunch of leaf and fern under footfall when finally reduced to a feeble splinter forced between incisors after a grizzled meal? What of the organ of life, the symbol of philia, agape, and eros, reduced by some to the swoosh and rhythmic fold of an electrocardiogram screen, T waves, peaks, and troughs. Sometimes new muscle is needed to preserve the persistence of a pump, but a poet's heart is another matter. It triumphs over squeeze of tissue, over throb of blood through veins. When muscle stills and sinew stiffens, the poet's heart continues to beat in every word, line, and stanza. The heart of a poet pulses the thunder of language, pervades the hunger of desire, the placid pleasure or torrid turbulence of romance, and does so with a rigor that defies mortis. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Hey, I would just like to close with a poem by another poet, if that would be all right. And I've been, this has been just such a hard two or three years for so many people. It's been just one thing after another. And for people who have somebody who's at their back, who's what's the expression? Backed up by somebody. It can be sort of getting through it can be not so bad, but for folks who don't have that, it has to be awfully hard. And so I am grateful for this community. This poem goes out to everybody who's, you know, had moments in which they went, oh my gosh, I can't believe what else is going to happen here. And it's actually a poem by Lauren Russell from What's Hanging on the Hush. And she is, I have a couple of things in common. We both grew up in LA. We both have asthma. We're both nearsighted. And we both had a hell of a time with geometry. She had a poem here that I came across today about loneliness, which I think is something that we don't talk about very much. So I think if you have a chance to think of somebody who might be a little bit more on their own than they might like to be, this might be a good time to just reach out and say, how you doing? On loneliness. I am lonely because I could not learn to be a body. I was born upside down and could never balance on one foot. I was lonely because there were too many cherry popsicles. I was holding out for mango, and thus I missed the lesson of sucking up. I was there for the lesson on ventriloquism. Be careful when you transfer your voice to another. She might sell it on eBay. He might dump it into the compost bin. You might be like the Little Mermaid, lost outside your element, unable to speak to the handsome prince. That is how I feel at parties. but I never had a singing lobster to help me adjust. I am lonely because I shy away from lobsters. I saw them crammed together in the supermarket tank, desperate with their pincers bound. I was 14 when I became a vegetarian. I was 9 when I stopped watching TV. I am lonely because I do not have a television. When someone talks about the latest reality show, I say, what's that? Who's that, actually? And I feel bored and superior. I was 15 when I read Lolita in the bath, an advantage of contact lenses to be read in a room full of steam. I am lonely because I stopped wearing contact lenses. Some mornings, someone steps onto the fire escape and empties a bucket of bowl or bedpan or bamboo pot. I am always half asleep and myopic. Without my glasses, I cannot tell if the dumper is a man, woman, child, or angel. I am lonely because I never go out to the window to find out. Well, in 2 weeks. So Lauren Russell, she's teaching at Michigan State. She was the assistant director of the Center for African American Poetics, Poetry and Poetics at Pitt. And I sure miss her. She was just a great poet. I'd love to have her back. Tuesday, July the 12th, week 6, Heather McNauer, Richard St. John, right here, Angel Ellis, Danielle Obisi Orlu, and Don Wentworth. Thank you, everyone here at White Whale. Thank you to White Whale. Thank you, Zoom World. And hope to see you in 2 weeks. Take care out there. Okay.